experiences and about the experiences we have with God in particular. But I guess I want to start and say, if there's one thing I want you guys to take away tonight from what I say and all this other stuff, I want you to know the actual thing that I pulled out as a title: your experience is a brick, it's not the whole wall. So to kind of go with that, I kind of find the nature of our faith and belief very fascinating. Those are the things that we actually kind of need in our lives in order to truly live. And yet it feels like sometimes we treat them as passing articles or things that we only touch on in moments that are convenient to us. And I don't know that we really mean to be like that, but things around us start to pick up speed and we start moving with the flow of all that temporal traffic and we get going and all of a sudden we end up someplace and it's like, I don't know how I got here. And I don't know how to get back to where I was going. This isn't what I really intended, and so we kind of do that a little bit here and there. We kind of get busy. Busy is very easy for us as people, at least for me. If I'm overspeaking for the rest of you, I don't know, but for me, it's easy to get busy and lose sight of the things that I actually want to do because I just got caught up in the moment of, well, I'm doing this right now. And it might not be the thing that I'm actually supposed to be spending a lot of my time on, but it's the thing that I got tunnel vision on and stuck with for a long period. I think that we thrive in our connection with other people, regardless of where you might fall on any kind of personality or typing test or whatever. We all thrive on connection, in one way or another. We are hardwired to seek out those connections. The biggest one we're intended to seek out is our connection with God. And though we have, as people as a whole, not necessarily us in general, but as people, as human beings as a whole, we've come up with some really unique methods trying to establish that link. People do really weird things in their attempt to experience the divine. They do some odd things to kind of bridge that gap. And while they might have a spiritual experience, it may not have anything to do with the Lord. It may not have anything to do with God. They had an experience with the Spirit. That's not always a good thing, for the record. But for experience as a whole, it's something that I've really been thinking about. When we met as leadership to talk about what we wanted to focus on for 2020 and beyond, what is our focus as a church, we wanted to get back to the basics. We wanted to get back to the central things about what makes what we're supposed to be doing as Christians. Our central desire really is that everyone that we come in contact with, everyone that comes in here and is a part of this church and is part of this group, our desire is to see you fall more in love with Jesus. That is something that we are intending and hopefully working towards. One of the ways that we're working towards it is being good examples ourselves. Hopefully that will shine through. But we are people too, and so sometimes we make missteps. But we want to see you guys grow more in love with Jesus with every moment. We want you to find deeper and lasting connection in that relationship. We want it to be a defining part of our lives, and that does mean being examples of the kind of relationship building that we're guiding you towards. Modeling spiritual disciplines that bear fruit and impact people's lives for the better. And I had to ask myself as I finished writing that, what does that have to do with experience exactly? I have found in a long time that we kind of really hold on to the experiences and encounters that we have with the Holy Spirit, that we have with God. We hold on to those things really tightly. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. We'll talk about them. We crave them. We chase that high, much like somebody who chases a different kind of high does. We like that mountaintop experience. We like to have that encounter because it makes it feel in that moment, yes, this is real to me, and I want to keep going. It gives us a reason and something that we can hold on to keep going in the moments when it's not exactly feeling the same way. We should be seeking those out. We should be seeking after God with our whole beings and putting Him first in our lives daily. I feel like, though, the danger in placing too much emphasis on the experiences we have is that they cannot sustain us indefinitely. The experiences and encounters that you have, while good, cannot sustain you for the rest of your life. If you're building your entire faith on one great experience that you had, eventually it's going to crash, and it's not going to be fun. The good thing with your experiences is that your experiences are yours. No one can take those away from you. I find that to be powerful testimony because nobody can take your experience away. However, not everybody can share the exact same experience because they haven't had it. So I think the experience is a start. You can have a really great experience. It can be the starting point of your faith. It can be the thing that lights the fire to draw you into that relationship. But hanging on to that one experience or even a handful of them is not going to be enough to actually sustain you indefinitely. Like I said, and the experiences that you have are bricks in the wall. They are not the entire wall itself. There's a song for that, too, if you want to listen to it. Actually, no, it's really different from this. So, but yeah, we do need more than just the experiences and encounters we have. We need other bricks. We need other mortar to solidify the structure of the faith that we have. And so while I was doing my Bible reading the last couple of weeks, I've been in Exodus, and I just got to Leviticus, which is very tough for me because it's a lot of the same paragraph over and over again. Because it's just kind of giving you the same thing for the sacrifices and the different things that they're expected to do. And yeah, it's a lot of repetition. But in Exodus, I found a really great example of the children of Israel and having an experience and how that doesn't necessarily work out for them the same way. So we're going to look tonight. We're going to be in Exodus chapter 32. We're going to do a little bit of backstory before we go dive into the actual passage itself. So the TLDR Cliff Notes version of Exodus up to this point. The children of Israel have been in bondage for 400 plus years. God hears them. He sends Moses to tell Pharaoh, hey, I need you to let my people go. There's a great Prince of Egypt movie that you can watch that gives all this kind of part of it. He does. Pharaoh says, I'm not going to do that. So God pronounces judgment on Egypt through 10 plagues. All 10 plagues actually attack a specific deity in the Egyptian pantheon to prove that God, Jehovah, is mightier than any of the Egyptian gods. Pharaoh finally relents and says, you can go. They go out. They chase them down. The Israelites walk across the Red Sea on dry land. The Egyptians do not have the same experience, and they all drown. And they get out into the wilderness. They have some kind of hiccups, but God is providing every step of the way. They are provided with manna and quail to eat. They are provided a literal experience of the presence of God by being able to see a pillar of cloud during the day and a pillar of fire at night as they walk through the desert and through the wilderness. They are experiencing God doing some amazing things in their midst, probably more than any one of us can point to as an actual physical manifestation of seeing God at this point. Although I've heard some really great stories, and so if you have one, that's awesome, and I would love to hear it. But the Israelites have seen some pretty amazing things from God. They literally get to Mount Sinai, and they see the presence of God descending on the mountain in cloud and thunder and lightning. And they can hear the thundering voice of the Lord as the Ten Commandments are read up to this point. And they're fairly terrified, which I think is a legitimate response to what they are experiencing. So they have seen those experiences with the Lord. And despite all that, when God calls Moses further up the mountain to continue to give him information and to provide the tablets of the covenant, Moses is gone for 40 days and 40 nights, and apparently that is too long to hold on to the experiences that they have just had, as we're going to see as we start in Exodus 32. And it says at the beginning, starting in verse number 1, it says, now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, come make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And Aaron said to them, break off the golden earrings which are in your ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. Quick highlight, the word there that's translated to break or take is actually tear. So he literally says, tear out the earrings that you have in your ears and bring them to me, which they do. They broke those earrings off which are in their ears, and they brought them to Aaron. He received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. And then they said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you up out of the land of Egypt. So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Today is a feast to the Lord." Excuse me, tomorrow, feast to the Lord. Then they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings, and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. So, you know, wow. They've witnessed so many incredible things up to this point, but in just over a month, they want to try something different. We don't know what's taking Moses so long or if he's really ever even going to come back. For all we know, God killed him up there. So how about instead you make us some other things that we can point to as God that we can devote our energy to instead? They recognize that God has gone before them up to this point, and they would like to have some kind of manifestation or something to represent that as they continue to move towards the promised land. But they also want to kind of revert back to old habits and old vices and the idolatry that was practiced in Egypt. They want something physical that they can see and touch to present as the mighty deity that has delivered them. It is worth mentioning that this is not all of the people in the camp of the Israelites, even though it just kind of says the people. It's not everybody, nor is it the desire or this movement originating with the leaders and elders awaiting Moses' return. Much like our modern times, the will of the people grumbling the loudest and causing the most trouble often get their way in an effort to appease them and restore a modicum of peace. These were the people talking the loudest. They shouted down anybody else who was saying anything different. And Aaron does something for them. He didn't create the plan as an Aaron, but he did facilitate it in an effort to appease the mob. He tells them to bring their golden earrings, torn out, per the word used here, and then he melts them down and fashions a golden calf. The word calf in English is not a great representation of the word that's actually used in Hebrew. The Hebrew word used here is igel, and is meant more as a young bull in the prime of its strength. It's talking about what would be a very virile kind of symbol, and in some cultures would it be interpreted as maybe a fertility type symbol. This statue is something Aaron carefully considered and created. So the sin here may not have originated with him, but he certainly facilitated it happening. The people see Aaron's work and proclaim it to be their God that led them out of Egypt. Aaron did not anoint the statue as God, and he did not proclaim it himself to be God. He simply went along with the will of the people, which is something somebody in a true spot of leadership would have maybe stepped back and went, oh, maybe we shouldn't do this. Maybe this is a bad idea. He may have even thought he was trying to steer them back in the right direction by proclaiming a feast to the Lord the next day. But the people were quickly falling back into the ideas of worship that they would have learned in Egypt. They sacrificed to the idol itself, and they engaged in revelry that included drunkenness and orgies and other things based on the word, the verbiage used here for play that we translate into English as play. It was definitely a sexual nature that they were talking about. So this is not exactly a great thing that's happening just 40 days after they have seen some really amazing stuff. How is that possible, really? Less than 2 months prior to this, they heard the literal thundering of God's voice as the Ten Commandments were read aloud to the nations, and now they're engaging in this. One could suggest that the experience did not change their hearts for the better, but instead made them desire a less demanding God. They wanted a safe God. They wanted one that they could look at and carry before them, but that wouldn't shake the whole mountain, and its presence wouldn't ask them to do anything contrary to their own wishes. Our modern age, people still seek God in this manner. They still want a safe God. We want a nice, polite God that is at our beck and call when we need or want something, but has the good sense to keep to himself otherwise. You know, he doesn't ask much from us, and he fits neatly into our political and social boxes. He agrees with all of our thoughts and just wants to give us good vibes and a positive spirit. He doesn't pass any judgment on us and just loves us with no expectation that we make any effort at holiness. Does that sound right? Does that sound like some people that you've heard stuff from? Does that actually sound like God, or does that sound like a human being, a person that just wants that? There is nothing really palatable about a safe God, because if God is safe, he is not holy, and he is not good. We're going to keep going in Exodus. We're back to now chapter 32, verse 7. And so, and the Lord said to Moses, go and get down, for your people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and indeed it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them and I may consume them. And I will make you a great nation. Then Moses pleaded with the Lord his God and said, Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak and say, he brought them out to harm them, to kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce wrath and relent from this harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have spoken of I give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. So the Lord relented from the harm which he said he would do to his people. So just in case you think God wasn't paying attention to everything that was happening, he was. He knew what they were doing. And he was quite unhappy about it based on the description that we have there. He was really ready to disown the people, wipe them out, and start over with Moses. All Moses would have had to do is just kind of stand aside and let it happen. Okay, God, you know best. I'll just be over here waiting for you to finish. Thankfully, Moses doesn't do that. I really appreciate when God, the way it's written is God speaking, he's like to Moses, your people whom you have led out of Egypt. And I would have been like, oh, time out. What do you mean my people? I'm not doing this. They're your people, God. And basically in a way of saying, he says, no, Lord, your people. It's also Moses kind of being humble and saying, hey, I'm not you. These are not my people to command and to worship me. Moses intercedes and calls on the merciful nature of God that he has seen. He pleads for them. God, it was your grace that led us out of Egypt. Please don't turn from dealing with us in grace and mercy. Please don't let your glory be diminished in the eyes of the nations who saw the great works, only to have you lead us out into the wilderness to be killed. Moses is concerned with God's grace, but he's also concerned with God's glory, because he doesn't want God to be diminished in the eyes of the other nations who saw the great and mighty things that he did. So he pleads for the Lord to remember the promises he made to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Moses approaches God in intercession for what he knew to be the heart of God for his people. Some of the commentators that I read while going over this really talked about the fact that it was never really God's intention to destroy, but also to provide, to see what Moses would do. And I could see that to a certain extent. We really have Moses as the one writing this, so we're kind of hearing it all from the perspective that he would have had, divinely inspired, but the way that events happened. But I think Moses knew in his own heart what God's heart truly was and was like, hey, I'm gonna plead for these people. Please don't do this to them. It's really interesting, and actually I really think in certain parts of it, and I think it's kind of a tangent, but there, the word where it says God in verse 14, so God relented. I know in the King James it actually translates it to, and God repented of the evil he intended to do to his people. And it's very interesting, whereas other translations go with relent rather than repent, because it's a much better translation of the actual wording that would have been used in Hebrew. But I know from the specific text, people have taken that to kind of compare it to Numbers 23 here it says, in King James, it says God repented, and in Numbers 23, it says God has no need to repent because he's not a man, which is true. And I think it's really just a mistranslation of actual wording that's used. And that's a tangent, really. But God relented. God was turned away from actually destroying, because someone interceded on the behalf of the people. You could almost say that God turned away for Moses' sake because of what Moses did, because Moses actually did the right thing interceding for the people, for the heart of God. In the same way that Abraham interceded for the people of Sodom and Gomorrah, and said, hey, what if there are 50 people who are righteous? Okay, well, if there's 50, I won't do it. And he continues to go until it finally gets down to 10, and there still weren't 10 righteous people, and Sodom and Gomorrah got destroyed. And that's unfortunate, I guess, for them. All right, so Exodus 32, back to verse 15. It said, "And Moses turned and went down from the mountain, and the two tablets of the testimony were in his hand. The tablets were written on both sides, on one side and on the other were written. Now the tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. And when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, 'There is noise of war in the camp.' But he said, 'It is not the noise of shout of victory, nor the noise of the cry of defeat, but the sound of singing that I hear.' So it was, as soon as he came near to the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing. And so Moses' anger became hot, and he cast the tablets out of his hand and broke them at the foot of the mountain. Then he took the calf which they had made, burned it in the fire, ground it into powder, and he scattered it on the water and made the children of Israel drink it. And Moses said to Aaron, 'What did this people do to you that you have brought so great a sin upon them?' So Aaron said, 'Do not let your anger of my Lord become hot. You know the people, they are all set on evil. For they said to me, "Make us gods that shall go before us. For this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And I said to them, "Whoever has any gold, let them break it off." So they gave it to me, and I cast it into the fire, and this came out. This calf came out. We're going to get to that last part in a second. So from here, it's Moses' turn to share in the righteous anger of the Lord. So Moses comes down, and now he, after begging and pleading for, hey, don't do that, don't destroy them, he gets to actually physically see what they're doing, and he loses it. And Moses has a history of anger issues. He killed an Egyptian in anger. He broke the tablets here. Later on, he beats on a rock instead of talking to it like he was asked to. But this anger is warranted and justified. As soon as he gets close and sees the idol and the people celebrating, he can't stand it. He throws the two stone tablets to the ground and breaks them. Tablets written on front and back by the very finger of God. One could even say that this wasn't just an action of mere anger, but a ceremonial representation of the broken law and covenant he was witnessing upon his return. He utterly destroys the idol, grinding it into powder and then forcing them to drink it, which is really brutal. But this is kind of symbolic in multiple ways. It showed the Israelites that the statue was nothing more than a work of human hands, easily destroyed and worthless. It was an immediate punishment for their sin. And it makes the gold completely unusable for any other purpose due to its corrupt nature. And then he confronts Aaron. And this is, of this particular section, this part, I was like, what? So he said, "What do these people do to you that you would lead them into so great a sin? What were you thinking?" Aaron does a good bit of blame shifting and scapegoating. And he also, outright lying. He says, "Hey man, take it easy. You know the hearts of this group are set on some bad things. They told me to make them some gods since they weren't sure if you'd ever be coming back. So I told them to tear out their earrings and bring them to me. When they did so, I tossed the gold into the fire and then this bull statue came out." It was wild. What? Aaron messed up and he knew it. Rather than just admit it and ask for mercy, he decides it's easier to make up a bit of a story because he was lazy. If he were actually a good leader of people, he would have told them, "Hey, this is not something we should do at all. I don't care how many of you there are, or how angry you are, or how much you want to have something else. This is not what God has commanded us to do." But he opts for the easy way, the path of least resistance, when actually dealing with the people, instead of standing up for what's right, and that leads to some serious consequences for a large number of people in the camp, as we're about to see. Exodus 32, now in verse 25, says, "Now when Moses saw that the people were unrestrained, for Aaron had not restrained them to their shame among their enemies, then Moses stood in the entrance of the camp and said, 'Whoever is on the Lord's side, come to me.' And all of the sons of Levi gathered themselves to him. And he said to them, 'Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let every man put his sword on his side and go in and out from entrance to entrance throughout the camp. And let every man kill his brother, every man his companion, every man his neighbor.' So the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. Then Moses said, 'Consecrate yourselves today to the Lord that he may bestow on you a blessing this day, for every man has opposed his son and his brother.'" So Moses isn't having everything in seven. To be unrestrained, the way that is listed here, it also goes, when you go further into the Old Testament, it talks about the idea of everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And anytime you see that, whenever you're reading the Old Testament, it means the people are really lost and are really just doing whatever feels good, much to their own detriment. And so Moses issues a call. He says, you're either with the Lord or you're against him. And this incident with the golden idol ends with 3,000 men dead, probably more people in total, considering women aren't numbered here. It is likely that the people killed in this incident were those who were most flagrant, I wrote a word that I can't always pronounce, that's fun, in their idol worship, or those who had led the call of the people that instigated this whole mess. These people who were killed were not just random people that they wandered through. These were people who were actually probably the leaders of the group who were intending to sow this dissension. We're going to finish up the last bit of the chapter here. So 32 now to verse 30. It says, now it came to pass the next day that Moses said to the people, you have committed a great sin, so now I will go up to the Lord, and perhaps I can make atonement for your sin. Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, oh, these people have committed a great sin and have made for themselves a god of gold. Yet now if you will forgive their sin, but if not, I pray, blot me out of your book you have written. And the Lord said to Moses, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. Now therefore, go lead the people to the place which I have spoken to you. Behold, my angels shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I visit for punishment, I will visit punishment upon them for their sin. So the Lord plagued the people because of what they did with the calf which Aaron had made. The Lord plagued them, and that really refers to the fact that 3,000 people just died for what they did. It is very important to note and recognize that of the people who are part of this group, nobody in this generation, with the exception of Joshua and Caleb, actually made it into the promised land. And that was the punishment, which then it is fully meted out later when they refuse to go in when God tells them to. And then they are forced to wander in the desert for 40 more years until all of that generation has passed away. That is the fulfillment of the punishment upon those who were actually participating in this particular incident. Having seen the full measure of the sin that the people committed, Moses goes up again to intercede on behalf of the people. He even offers himself as a substitute. He's like, please forgive them, but if you can't forgive them, I put it on me instead of them. Which God does not do at this point, but it does kind of foreshadow something that will be coming later in the person of Jesus. He does extend his mercy to the nation as a whole, but he does reserve the right to judge the individual hearts of the people. And like I said, the entire generation here does not make it into the promised land. And so that might seem like a bit of an extreme example of what I talk about when experienced, but these people had experienced some really amazing works of God, and yet they still kind of fell way to a place that they weren't supposed to be. And I don't think that, you know, that's necessarily where we are, but we all kind of fall into things. We all kind of maybe get to a point where we're just kind of doing day to day without really kind of experiencing God the way that we could. Life really is full of uncertain times, and we walk into some days not being able to feel the joy and power of that experience we had, and we're unable to see when the next one is going to come. If we haven't been putting in the work to build our faith and a stronger foundation to stand on, we might fall for the first easier thing that comes our way, and we might miss out on the moments that he is preparing us for. We talked last week about the rhythm of the rain seasons in Israel and learning the differences between them so that we can operate optimally. I think this is much the same in that we are walking through the valleys and pressing on through difficult moments so that we can make the climb and enter into the next experience that fuels and sustains us as we move on to the next season. It's a journey. It's not a sprint. It's a marathon, if you will. I'm using all my favorite cliches tonight. I think that he is there with us every step. We just need to listen for his voice and the guidance of his spirit. Sometimes that means taking action. Other times it means we pause and reflect. And then the discipline that we're trying to emulate is the fact that we need to balance the two. That's what I have for tonight. I really hope that, like I said, if you don't remember anything else, remember that your experiences are bricks, not the whole wall. There's a lot of other stuff that makes up the wall and the foundation, the building, whatever you want to liken your faith to. I guess maybe wall's not always a great example these days. We are building our faith on something, and if we are not having a foundation that is worth standing on, it's going to be really, really hard to stand up and move forward. So I'm going to pray for us, and then we can head out to do whatever else we would like to do this evening.